Anyway, I wasn't doing that much research. I was just showing you all the different possible schemes. My recommendation for attacking this midterm project is to pick situations or scenarios in something that works. Take it as far as you can and say, here's where it doesn't work and why. And that's probably what would be done in a published paper. You would test your algorithm. You would show, here is when it works. Here is where it failed. Here's why it failed. And I would think that situations where you don't have any cars, where you've got multiple painted lane markers, or if you want to be really interesting, you could go for a curb instead of painted lines. So there are multiple ways to tackle this. If there are particular sections now of this that you really, really like, that you want for your project, let me know. As I said, I'm not really sure that I want to put 9,000 images up there for you. I just don't think you need that many. But I think there's some good subsets here. And you can see, when you're looking at this, how ideal the images for Project 2 were. They were pretty nice. You know, you would want to say, my midterm project is going to be, I'm just going to detect the crossing white lines. But you may have to then say, well, will it work if they're crossed? Will it work if they change in width? Will it pick up, for example, all of those patches in the road? Will it respond to changes from dark, i.e. shade? You've got to restrict your midterm project algorithm to a subset. Okay? Any questions? Any special questions? Nothing? As you can tell, it is not an easy task. It's just like working on your thesis or dissertation. Pick something small, a smaller set that you can solve. Believe it or not, you can do a modest amount with what you know. Question? That's also up in the air, because you can define it different ways. Okay, remember, you've got a format for the paper you're going to write, but I have it pretty wide open. You can find lane markers. If you're going to do something like that, the ideal thing is you want to exclude everything but lane markers. How would you do that? If you are going to find our lines, which denote, and by the way, I guess this is the first thing we really have to do, which is stop at a white line. Okay, when is that due? Anyone remember? Is that March? Now, that will probably be a modestly simple situation where there aren't too many extraneous white lines. But how would you go about building something that would, that is designing an algorithm that would stop? So what you have to do, and this gets into output, if you're going to have one of these crossing white line detectors, that's the approach you're going to take. Don't worry. Then the kind of output I'm interested in, you could submit a movie if you wanted, but I'm more interested probably in stills, which would show where it worked and where it didn't work. So, for example, if you had a situation like this, that doesn't work. You could say, okay, I cross lines of different kinds and types. It's found correct crossing in 49 of them. And a wonderful type of output that's quantized. I mean, you want to and I think that's the best way. You don't need to do Excel. Well, I mean, you may use anything you want for your calculation. But the bottom line is a couple stills illustrating how well you did. Because just getting down to a simple image like this from those natural scenes that we looked at is not easy. That can get into playing a lot with the canny operator. You might be playing a lot, which is Gaussian filter standard distribution that is the smoother. It, you know, that you may want to use something like that, for example. If this were the background of a road, you would want something to smooth out all of the fine details in the road. You're looking for something thick. If you're looking for these lines to stop at, and you're ignoring the lanes, you may not want to use a Huff transform. If you're looking for lane marker, you may want to use a Huff transform. If you're looking for markers like this, you may use a special kind of Huff transform. Because remember, the Huff transform, one version of it is to find all possible straight lines. What's the obvious thing here? I'm not interested in all possible straight lines. I am interested in straight lines with some very specific characteristics. Now, if you need some data to test, let us know. Scott will be back. I'm not quite sure when. Tuesday, Wednesday? He's doing everything by email right now. The one thing it seemed to me as we went through all of the video is that we don't have any good slow turns. We've got sharp turns at intersections. But I guess this is sort of true with cities. Most of the stuff is straight. I mean, there was that one intersection that was at some kind of 45-degree angle. Okay, so that's sort of the background. Last chance for comments, questions. I'm going to try and devote a short period, maybe not as long as this one, every lecture where you can talk. If you've got something that really looks good, you found a really good routine, like someone's got an unbelievable Huff algorithm that they've published on their website, or that you hacked into the Carnegie Mellon website and you've got their complete routines, you know. Whatever. There's a lot of stuff on the web, and someone, I forgot, just sent me a really good, I guess it's a blog that someone was writing about image processing. And it's got some really nice examples in it and stuff, and one of the things was experience of transform in MATLAB. So there's a lot of stuff on the web. A, finding good stuff. Opportunity. Any questions? Project. You know, like I haven't already marked you down with a big F. Everyone has the opportunity to do whatever helps. Okay? But I'd like to see you all solve a different part of the puzzle. We put them all together and we've got the greatest driving algorithm in the world. It won't work quite that easily. But as I said, try to focus on something that will work. The obvious ones are detecting crossing lines, lane markers. You can try something more esoteric. And outside the box, color segmentation seems interesting. Huff transforms seem interesting. Candy operators seem interesting. But you could go, you could try some kind of temporary matching. Talk about all kinds of algorithms. You could adopt a biological algorithm. But I suspect you can do a fair bit with what you know. And don't worry, that's not going to drive the vehicle. If you only detect 10 crosses, out of 79 crossings, that may still be a very good result. This is a challenging problem. It's real data, not fake. That's the hard part. And the most challenging part is to simply throw away all of the unrelated data. There is an awful, awful lot in each image. That is your biggest challenge. Okay? So you're going to think outside the box? Okay. Good. Okay. I wanted to pick up on a couple little things we started talking about the Fourier transform last time. Come back to it in a moment, but especially after we've just been discussing edges and stuff, I don't know if I told you about the edge operator in MATLAB. I know some of you used it on your device and found out about it, but it turns out there is an edge operator called edge, and it's five different. Actually, six. A Sobel, a Prewitt, a Roberts, a Laplacian of a Gaussian, zero crossings, or a Cannon. And we just recently talked about the Prewitt operator. You don't have to write one. It's already. This just shows some very simple how you use them. They're fairly simple. Basically, you have an input function, an output function, an optional threshold. Remember, the output of this is going to be a grayscale image, and you can have a threshold everything below, that is, ignore everything below a certain value in the output image. That's optional. And the parameters vary by the method. The method is just like everything else, you put a single quote. And some example right here where you just read in an image. Maybe next time I'll show you a bunch of MATLAB examples of this and some other things. But edge, F, Sobel, and their default parameters. Most of the MATLAB image processors do have default. The problem with edge stuff, especially, is you have something more like a Gaussian ball or a Cannon operator, it turns out that it's very sensitive to the parameters of the filter. I've stressed this a couple times, and you noticed it a little bit the last time when I showed you the Cannon operator output images. Remember the clown at the mirror? And by changing the width of the Gaussian, you could make fine detail go away. That you have to play with the parameters. Let's see. Sobel All there is there's a threshold for the log. And this is, when I say log, I do not mean logarithm. This is the Laplacian of Gaussian. The idea is, and we're going, you're going to see Gaussian filters over and over and over again. The reason is that they're very, very good at getting rid of noise. They're easy to implement. Mathematically, they're nice to analyze. And what you can even show is that under certain conditions, they actually are optimum filters. So they have all kinds of good things. Anyway, you've got a deviation, which is the width of the Gaussian. You've got an output threshold. And this is, you really usually want, with a Laplacian, a fairly big, broad filter. And the reason is it's a second derivative operator. So if you don't filter out a lot of stuff, you're going to get a huge number of lines in your output. You'll get a huge amount of noise. Okay? And then finally, the canny. And the only difference with the canny and the other operators is that it has two thresholds. So you have to put in an array. It's only got two elements in it, but in this case, and you always, always, and this is especially true, as we'll see in a moment with the Fourier transform, if you're not sure of the values that you have, that you're going to get from a filter operation, just take a look at the matrix elements. They may not be in the range that you think they are. When you start doing derivatives, when you start doing logarithms, when you start doing Fourier transforms, we shift things. You get a black picture or an all-white picture as a result of something in MATLAB or ImageJ, chances are you've scaled it wrong. Okay? And I guess that's about all I'll say right there. But function EVGE, edge. Now, Fourier transform. We talked about them the last time, but I actually didn't tell you about the MATLAB functions for Fourier transforms. And it turns out they're really, really very simple. We have FFT2, and we have IFFT2. Stands for fast Fourier transform, two dimension. IFFT2 stands for inverse fast Fourier transform, two dimension. And there's really not very much to them. For example, here we just read in a figure, we Fourier transform it. In this case, and this is the first thing, the Fourier transform, remember, is real numbers, in principle complex numbers, very large dynamic range. Usually you want to take, in this case, an absolute value and show the magnitude. That would be your Fourier spectrum. And we just show it. And if you don't watch what you're doing, and unfortunately I didn't show the right bad image here, you'll get the one that has the stuff in the corners. If you get stuff in the corners, you can do what I did, which is you multiply by -1 to the x plus y before you Fourier transform. But the other thing you can do is, this comes up so often, there's an FFT shift routine. You just say FFT shift, and it centers it. And that's what we did here. We moved it to the center. Now, the typical problem that you will get into with the Fourier that you didn't get into with anything else. Question?
Yeah, is that shift before you do the Fourier or after?
After. Yeah, that's a shift afterwards. That's a shift in the Fourier domain. But you could multiply the image here, say minus 1 to the x plus y before, that there are multiple ways of doing this now. But since they put a routine in, that's very nice. It's fast, it's simple, it's one line. Okay? And then again, we're going to show the absolute value, the magnitude. Now, that's showing this. It's centered. You notice that its weight at the center, that would correspond to 0, 0. I'm going to talk about units more. But 0, 0, well, what's zero frequency? It's DC. It's the average value of the picture. If you have a bright picture, the 0, 0 or DC term will be very bright. If you have a dark picture, it will be much dimmer. And I'm going to show you what happens when you actually change that or get rid of it as a filter. You know, this is the stuff like in 246 when you study Fourier stuff, but it's very visual now. Now, the one thing is that I show here is this is a typical way to transform the normal FFT so that you can really see all of the detail. Because out here, there's information. It's just that you've got too large a dynamic range to see it. Okay. So the very first thing is that we are going to convert to double precision floating point. We're going to do, anyone remember this transformation? Yes. Yes. Yes and no. The yes is, if you look at the complex numbers, absolutely. Because if you shift something in space, it's a phase shift in the frequency domain. So there is a phase shift. But when we take the magnitude, usually that will disappear. So technically, yes. But if we're just looking at images, no. Most images. And if we really want to get into the 2D Fourier transform, I'll do all the integrals and I'll do all the series and we'll look at all of those properties. But I don't think we need to do that here. I see you agree. Okay. What we want to do is learn how to use it and also to try and identify most of the problems when we've made a simple mistake. So if you get a really dark image or a black image, or rarely a white image, chances are it's scaled wrong. So you can do the log transformation to compress everything. Basically, you're making it smaller. At this point, everything is really a matrix. You see, this is sort of what the real problem is when you get down to it. It's a matrix of complex numbers. And what is a normal image that we display? It's an array of 0 to 255. It's an array of bytes. So that's where what you have to do is, first of all, convert the matrix into a grayscale image. And it turns out, and I messed this one up. That only converts it into the range 0 to 1. You've got to convert it now to bytes. And now, once you do that, you've taken all of your range, you've compressed it, you've put it into, actually, you've mapped it into bytes. Okay. And this is only the simplified log transform for the intensity. In general, you can put a constant in there to scale it some more. But to get things to look good, you often have to play with them. Same thing, like these. With Gaussians involved, if you're going to use a Gaussian, you're going to have to play with the parameters of the filter. It has to be adjusted. Okay. Any quick questions or comments on MATLAB? It's got some pretty powerful Fourier stuff, and it's really nice that everything is hidden, basically, in that. Not like the old days when we had to write all of our routines. Your assignment would have been to do that FFT in 2D. Now, remember, we looked at this one the last time, and this is where we just were. This was the Fourier transform of this image. We had noticed that the Fourier transform is really good for finding the axes of things. If you've got a large component in that direction, a large component in that direction, those same axes will show up in the Fourier transform. It is often used in robotics to determine the orientation of unknown objects. And you see it shows up very nicely here. And I think I pointed out the last time there is sort of a dashed line that's a little fainter right here, corresponding, you see, corresponds to the Fourier transform of the width of that. And it's approximately perpendicular to it. And yes, there would be a Fourier transform of something in the other direction, but notice, it's really big here. So what does that mean in terms of here? That's going to be really narrow, probably so narrow that you can't see it in the center. Okay. Now, it turns out, and maybe you prefer to do it this way depending upon your background. One of the things, well, actually this is an overview for frequency domain, i.e. Fourier transform image processing. Most of the time in the past you've called it simply filtering. And you've done low-pass filters and high-pass filters. But we're going to show you some different things that you can do and some issues. Okay. This actually, by the way, is exactly what you'd be doing, Gorn. You'd Fourier transform, you do a filter operation, and then you inverse Fourier transform. Because we're usually not interested in looking at our final result in the frequency domain. Usually, we want to put in an image, and we want to get out an image. Now, how about that filter? Well, one of the big things, and our book hammers this point home over and over, we tend to do everything centered with 0, 0 at the center. We've shifted our origin from the upper left-hand corner to the center. To do that, we have to convert the input image. And usually, and you can do this explicitly for each element in the array, or that FFT shift can do it all for you. But basically, you have to multiply by -1 to the x plus y. What is that really doing? I told you about it the last time. What it's really doing, and in fact that was the response to our question, if I move something in space, what happens is that introduces a phase shift in the frequency space, in the frequency domain. And if we introduce a phase shift in the space domain, we can get a shift in the frequency domain. Remember those properties of Fourier transforms? If you shift in one, you get a phase in the other. And that's exactly what you're doing here. In essence, we're shifting it in phase, and that results in a spatial shift, well, I really shouldn't say spatial, but in a linear shift of the transform in the frequency domain. So, first thing you do, actually, these are usually the first two steps. Center it and Fourier transform it. Then, filtering is really simple. Filtering is we usually take some operation and we just multiply in the frequency domain. Remember, in the space domain, we'd take that little mask and slide it around. That is the spatial equivalent of convolution. With this, once you've done this operation, you don't have to do anything else. You just, in essence, do a point-by-point transform. And the filter that we will be using are usually very simple. They are usually real. And I'll show you what some low-pass filters look like. Technically, if you're into all of this, they're known as zero phase filters. Because we are not doing any phase operation. Now remember, the result of this thing where we took the original image, we're multiplying it by the phase factor, that's what I told you the last time is this shifted transform in the frequency domain. I take this filter and it's implicit that it's centered. So I've got both of these centered. This is real. This can be complex. So I'm multiplying complex by real. Okay? That's the whole filter operation. Doing that multiplication. To get everything back, I simply do an inverse Fourier transform of that and that product. Okay? And then there's one last little thing. It's still centered. Okay? This was centered, so it's got a phase shift when it comes back to the space domain. I need to multiply this again. Basically, I'm canceling out this, if you want to think of it that way. If I originally multiplied it by minus 1 to the x plus y, I have to multiply it by minus 1 to the x plus y at the end. And what's minus 1 times minus 1? 1. So this gets rid of all of the pluses and minuses that I created. Okay, so it seems like a long roundabout process. And it can be, you know, you're going to ask, well, why in the world do we subject you to Fourier transforms? Because this does look awfully complicated. Well, it turns out doing Fourier transforms can be done fairly fast. In fact, it can be done at the speed of light with lenses. There are fast ways to do Fourier transforms. There's also a second reason for doing this. The second reason is we can do filter design here. We can say, oh, I want this. I'll do my operations here. I'll design a filter. And then I'll work backwards and say, what would it look like in the spatial domain? So you can use this for filter design. Now, what is probably the most obvious example of a filter, at least to me? You may not agree. I'm going to take that original SCM that had that broken lead, and I'm going to do one thing. Let's back up. I'm going to, in the frequency domain, remove only the 0-0 component. So my filter consists of something that's completely black, except for one white dot representing one, right at the center. Actually, I have that backwards. Sorry, I want this. It's one everywhere except at the center. That's my 0-0, and that's a value of 0. So I'm multiplying only the component there by 0, getting rid of it. Everything else is multiplied by 1. It doesn't change anything else. The 0-0 component, if you remember your Fourier, but the important thing to us is it represents the average intensity of the image. So it's always the average intensity. And by removing it, what you can do is shift the image level. So I take the original, I multiply that center component by 0, and I get that. And what is it? It's a dark image, right? Well, you may or may not want that. And this is a very, very simple idea that I can remove a frequency component. In fact, unlike an ordinary filter, if you've designed digital filters, I can go in that two-dimensional Fourier, pick any term I want, get rid of it selectively, enhance it selectively, do all kinds of things. That's hard to do with time and frequency filters. Okay? Technically, that would be an example of a real low pass, a high pass filter, or more appropriately, a notch filter. Okay? Now, you can generalize what you've done in time and frequency in the past to images. Now, this looks a little bit like Gaussian, and it could be, but the general idea is, okay, this is a low pass, so it'll have a value of 1 at 0-0, and as you move out in the frequency domain, I multiply that by 1. As I move further and further out, I'm going to multiply by smaller numbers. The idea is that I'm getting rid of the high frequencies. I'm attenuating the high frequencies. And so my filter response in the Fourier domain might look like this. 1, 0, and that will be at 0-0, the center point, and then it'll go out to the edges. We can change the width, we can change the shape, there's all kinds. Now, what is the general effect of doing this? By getting rid of the high frequencies, the effect is to average the image, to smooth it. And that's what's done here. This is an averaged image. It's blurred. Usually, one of two things happen. Your camera lens is out of focus, or you've filtered the heck out of it, and it's become blurred deliberately. Now, you can do the inverse. And it really is the inverse. Instead of multiplying the frequencies at 0, 0, or near 0, 0 by 1, you could multiply them by 0. Okay, that's supposed to be symmetric. Multiply at the edges by 1. You see, what we're doing is we're passing only the high frequencies. We're getting rid of the low frequencies. Because this is low, and 0, 0 is usually what we call BC. It's the constant. Or average value. And we go to our maximum frequencies. And I'm going to talk about what the units are in a moment. Okay? But you can see that basically one is the inverse of the other. Oftentimes we will say that the high pass is 1 minus the low pass. And that's actually a fairly important thing because it tells us how to make a high pass filter from a low pass filter. Now, what does the output from a high pass filter look like? Well, stop and think for a moment. High pass. What's the most high frequency information in the image? Well, there are two kinds usually. One, noise. You know, if you're a graduate student, you know that your image will probably have nothing but noise in it. Okay? It won't be like these nice examples here in class. But if it's a good example with not too much noise, what's the other thing in a high pass? Well, it's where you have all the changes. The changes occur where? At edges. So what you are effectively doing with a high pass is it's an edge filter. Your low pass is an averaging filter. And you can see some of that right here. It's done a modestly good job. You can see some of the highlighted edges. How edgy it gets depends upon the shape. And that's one of the things that we're going to be talking about. What's the effect of different shapes? And you can do all kinds of simple manipulations. This is a relatively dark image. Remember, one of the things that I warned you about is you've got to watch the absolute scale of your image after you do any Fourier transform operations. It may not be 0 to 255. It may be shifted. And typically, when you do some of these filters, you have positive and negative values in here. It turns out that this is an image that has positive and negative values. When you take a derivative, you get positive and negative edges. That effect occurs in high-pass filters. So we can add a constant. In effect, all we're doing is we're shifting the overall level of that image right there. And now, here is the high-pass filter output just with a constant added to it. Now we can back up, see those two, and there's the original back there. So you can see, okay, the edges, let's go back to that high-pass one. And you can see it does a pretty good job of enhancing all of the little dots, you know, all the little bumps on our fabrication there. Okay. Now, I keep talking about Gaussian filters. We really like Gaussian filters, especially in the Fourier domain. Why? Because this is what the function looks like in the Fourier domain. This is what the function looks like in the spatial domain. The spatial domain is what we did in Chapter 3. This was the early stuff. Remember when we had our different masks? And in fact, here's a mask here, which is all ones. That's a pure averaging one. Here's a mask here. This is a center-weighted average. Okay? And think about how this looks in space. If I would, you know, sort of, I'd stand up here and look down on this in two dimensions, I'd see that hill, and this could be a very crude approximation to it. Okay? High in the center, rolling off a normalization constant. And the nice thing is that the Fourier transform of a Gaussian is a Gaussian. It doesn't change shape. But the important thing is, if it's really narrow in the frequency domain, it's very wide in the space domain. If it gets very narrow in the space domain, it gets wide in the frequency domain. They're related to each other. Now, what does the high pass look like? Okay, and how do you relate that to a Gaussian? Well, what we usually do is we actually represent this as the difference of Gaussians. I mean, you can see right here a very nice Gaussian. It's just a negative Gaussian. And your first response would be that it's subtracted from 1. Instead of subtracting it from 1, how about if I take a really big Gaussian, a really wide Gaussian? So it's a very wide Gaussian minus a narrow Gaussian. And if I take that as my model and inverse Fourier transform it, I get something that looks like this. This is also two Gaussians. That, and there's one like that. So if I had a difference here, I have a difference here. This, if you remember back, we didn't spend a whole lot of time on Laplacians, but what did the shape of the Laplacian look like? It had a big spike in the center. Remember, this is the second derivative. Had a big spike in the center. It could be positive or negative, but the ring around it would be the opposite sign. And so one of the ones that we had was a -4 surrounded by, or I'm sorry, a 4 surrounded by -1s. We had a 8 surrounded by -1s. Now, if you really remember what we did back then, we also had off-diagonal components. Remember, we looked at the Laplacian this way and this way and added the two together to get a spherically symmetric. Because what we've done here is we're doing the x and y. We're not looking specifically at the diagonals. You're getting an x and a y type. Okay? This is a frequency domain created high-pass filter which looks like a Laplacian, or at least our implementation of a Laplacian in the space domain. So high-pass is the same thing as taking a second derivative. You wouldn't normally think of it that way, would you? Now we can do a lot more. We're going to start with the simplest filter. The simplest filter is the ideal low-pass filter in two dimensions. It's going to have a radius of V0. Radius. So this thing looks like a cylinder. anything inside that cylinder gets multiplied by 1. Anything outside the cylinder gets multiplied by 0. Now, remember what you do in frequency domain filtering. You transform, you multiply, you inverse transform. That multiplication is what we're looking at. And that multiplication here is basically, if you were doing this optically, a piece of opaque material with a hole in the middle. Mathematically, it's ones in this circle, zeros everywhere else. It passes only the Fourier components. It throws away all the ones outside that radius. What does that do to a picture? Well, let's take a look at a picture, and then we're going to talk about how we can do things to our picture. Okay? This is actually a really, really interesting one and is somewhat of the basis for image compression, even though it doesn't look that way. We've taken an image over here, standard test pattern, and we've taken the two-dimensional Fourier transform. We've squared each component. Remember last time we talked about power spectra? If you square, that gives you something that's proportional to what we call the power. We can sum up the total power for all of those pixels and call that 100%. We'll just normalize by the sum of the squares of every Fourier coefficient. That's our normalization. If you want to think of it that way, it's the total amount of light that you see. Because the light is coming from the ones. So, we put some circles here at different radii. These would correspond, since this is the Fourier domain, and it's the square, we put these circles there. Said, what fraction of the power of the light in that image is represented by what's in those circles? In other words, if we stop right there, what are we throwing away outside that circle? And it's easier to see if you start and go in, because the inner circles are so small you can't see them. This is it says 500 by 500. It's probably rounded off to 512 by 512. Okay, so you can sort of get a feel for, this is probably 256 from the center out to each edge. Something on that order. Okay, the first circle is drawn at 230 pixels radius. It's not throwing away very much. And in fact, it is throwing away 0.5% of the image power. It's throwing away very little in terms of power. We'll come back and look at how much information that is in a moment. But in terms of signal power, very little. The next inner circle is 80. That still contains 98% of the image power. If you haven't noticed, there's not much power out here. That's why it's black. These are very close to zero. All the power's down there. We go in the next ring, which is this one here. That's 30 pixels. And you have 96.4%. And then the next one is 15, 94.6, and you can barely see it, but there's a 5 pixel in there, and that still has 92% of the signal power. Now, power does not necessarily translate to information, but that's power. Now let's see what it looks like in terms of the image. Okay. Here's the original image. Here's what it looks like corresponding to a low-pass filter, each of those previous rings. What did I mean when I said it sort of gave us the basis for image compression? Well, take a look. This picture looks pretty good compared to this one. They look pretty similar. This one had how much, though, information thrown away? That one had everything out here thrown away. So, you know, what's that? Maybe 15%, 20% of the total image we've thrown away out here. But let's look at what happens the next ring. That's a lot. We threw all of this away. We're keeping only that. That's this image. Well, you can, if you look at it, you can see that the edges are a little fuzzier. The detail, the high frequency detail, isn't as nice. And you can see some smoothing going on here, but you've probably thrown away 3/4 of the picture. That means that the file required to represent that image is only 1/4 of the original file. This is the way JPEG works. Now, it doesn't quite do it. It's not as simple as what I'm saying, but that's the idea. You throw away high-frequency information. Now, other things. This first one, which keeps just the very, very low-frequency terms, is so blurry, so averaged out that it's useless. You can see that we get detail back, but what shows up very well here is we have ringing. For those of you who remember ideal low-pass filters, they're really bad because they ring. They have transients. You have the very same thing in image processing. And I'll show you why in just a, actually very soon here. Okay. Actually, I want to back up. I wanted to talk about units here, which are really important. What's the relationship between units in the spatial domain and units in the frequency domain? And I keep calling them frequencies. And they are frequencies, but they're not quite the same. If we have a image, and you have to have some spatial dimensions to talk about this. So I'm going to say maybe it's 1 inch by 1 inch. A square image, I'm going to have get 512 pixels by 512 pixels. So what I actually will do is usually 0 to 511. And same thing here. And I think you get the feeling very readily that each one of these pixels is going to represent 1 inch divided by 512. So one 512 is the size of each pixel spatially. How about in the frequency domain? And I'm not getting into shifts right now. I'm just transforming it. And we'll have UV. Which one did I use for which? X, Y, U, V. You get exactly the same size at the output. Now, there are some cases where you don't. We're going to talk about that. The next lecture, that's going to be called padding, okay? But in general, you're going to have 0 to 511 pixels in each direction, what are the units now? Well, the units, instead of being over here, inches per pixel, over here are going to be cycles per inch. The 0, 0 over here corresponds to, well, actually, 0, 0 here corresponds to no cycles per inch. It's constant. If I'm down here, this corresponds to 511 cycles per inch. And if you stop and think, what does that mean over here in space? The highest frequency would be something that where every pixel is exactly alternating. Okay, and the lowest is that. And that's what the units over here are. 0 cycles per inch. 1 cycle per inch. You know, 1 cycle would be, and it just goes. You know, just like you had a sine wave, you build it up. Here, though, it's all done. It's square. And so those are the relationships between units. And what it comes down to is delta U, delta X, equals 1 over M, where M is the number of pixels. Delta X is your spacing over here between pixels. It's the size of the pixel. Okay? And then that automatically would determine what this width is over here and what it means. But units will be cycles per distance. This one will be distance per pixel. So that's the relationship between the two. And this is where we'll pick up the next time. This is just the shifting property, the convolution property of Fourier transforms. If you've got any special requests for images, I know. If you get any special requests for images for your project, any of those that you looked at today, that you really think we should have on the website, let me know. I'll do some editing. Oh, those are incorrect. Those are all totally wrong. That's why I told you to use the Project 2 images until I got better stuff up there. And when I took a look at these images, there's 9,000 of them, and I don't think anyone in here is going to test all 9,000.